Chapter 2 Nothing more came down the mail tube that day, and Joe Fernright trudged home. Home consisted of a room on a subsurface level of a huge apartment building. Once, the Jiffy View Company of Greater Cleveland came by every 6 months and created a 3D projection, animated, a view of Carmel, California. This view filled his room's window, or ersatz window. However, of late, due to his bad financial situation, Joe had given up trying to imagine that he lived on a great hill with a view of the sea and of towering redwoods. He had become content, or rather resigned, to face blank, inert black glass. And in addition, if that wasn't enough, he had let his psycho lease lapse. The encephalic gadget installed in a closet of his room, which, while he was home, compelled his brain to believe that his ersatz view of Carmel was authentic. The delusion was gone from his brain, and the illusion was gone from his window. Now, home, from work, he sat in a state of depression, reflecting, as always, on the futile aspects of his life. Once, the Cleveland Historical Artifacts Museum had sent him regular work. His hot-needle device had melted many fragments, had recreated into a single homogeneous unit one ceramic item after another, as his father had before him. But that was now over. All the ceramic objects owned by the museum had been healed. Here in his lonely room, Joe Fernright contemplated the lack of ornamentation. Time after time, wealthy owners of precious and broken pots had come to him, and he had done what they wanted. He had healed their pots, and they had gone away. Nothing remained after them, no pots to grace his room in place of the window. Once, seated like this, he had pondered the heat needle which he made use of. If I press this little device against my breast, he had ruminated, and turn it on, and put it near my heart, it would put an end to me in less than a second. It is, in some ways, a powerful tool. The failure, which is my life, he had thought again and again, would cease. Why not? But there was the strange note which he had received in the mail. How had the person, or persons, heard of him? To get clients, he ran a perpetual small ad in Ceramics Monthly, and via this ad, the thin trickle of work throughout the years had come. Had come, and now really had gone. But this, the strange note. He picked up the receiver of his telephone, dialed, and in a few seconds faced his ex-wife, Kate. Blonde and hard-lined, she glared at him. "Hi," he said, in a friendly sort of fashion. "Where's last month's alimony check?" Kate said. Joe said, "I'm onto something. I'll be able to pay all of my back alimony if this..." "This what?" Kate interrupted. "Some new nuthead idea you dredged out of the depths of what you call your brain?" "A note," he said. "I want to read it to you to see if you can infer anything more from it than I can." His ex-wife, although he hated her for it, and for a lot more, had a quick mind. Even now, a year after their divorce, he still relied on her powerful intellect. It was odd, he had once thought, that you could hate a person and never want to see them again, and yet at the same time seek them out and ask their advice. Irrational. Or, he thought, is it a sort of super-rationality, to rise above hate? Wasn't it the hate which was irrational? After all, Kate had never done anything to him, nothing except make him excessively aware, intently aware, always aware, of his inability to bring in money. She had taught him to loathe himself, and then, having done that, she had left him. And he still called up and asked for her advice. He read her the note. "Obviously, it's illegal," Kate said. "But you know your business affairs don't interest me. You'll have to work it out by yourself or with whoever you're currently sleeping with. Probably some 18-year-old girl who doesn't know any better, who doesn't have any basis for comparison as an older woman would have." "What do you mean illegal?" he asked. "What kind of pot is illegal?" "Pornographic pots. The kind the Chinese made during the war." "Oh, Christ," he said. He hadn't thought of that. Who but Kate would remember those? She had been lewdly fascinated by the one or two of them which had passed through his hands. "Call the police," Kate said. "Anything else on your mind?" Kate said. "Now that you've interrupted my dinner and the dinner of everyone who's over here tonight." "Could I come over?" he said. Loneliness crept through him and edged his question with the fear which Kate had always detected, the fear that she would retract into her implacable chess-piece fort, the fort of her own mind and body out of which she ventured to inflict a wound or two and then disappear back in, leaving an expressionless mask to greet him. And by means of that mask, she used his own failings to injure him. "No," Kate said. Why not? Because you have nothing to offer anyone in the way of talk or discussion or ideas. As you've said many times, your talent is in your hands. Or did you intend to come over and break one of my cups, my Royal Albert cups with the blue glaze, and then heal it, as a sort of magical incantation designed to throw everyone into fits of laughter? Joe said, I can contribute verbally. Give me an example. What? He said, staring at her face on the screen of the phone. Say something profound. You mean right now? Kate nodded. Beethoven's music is firmly rooted in reality. That's what makes him unique. On the other hand, a genius as he was, Mozart... Shove it, Kate said and hung up. The screen went blank. I shouldn't have asked if I could come over, Joe realized with acute misery. It gave her that opening, that foot in the psychic door that she uses, that she preys on. Christ, he thought, why did I ask? He got up and wandered drearily about his room. His motion became more and more aimless until at last he stopped and simply stood. I have to think about what really matters, he told himself. Not that she hung up or said anything nasty, but whether or not that note I got in the mail today means anything. Pornographic pots, he said to himself. She's probably right. And it's illegal to heal a pornographic pot, so there goes that. I should have realized it as soon as I read the note, he said to himself. But that's the difference between Kate and me. She would know right away. I probably wouldn't have known until I had finished healing it and then taken a good, firm look at it. I'm just not bright, he said to himself. Compared to her, compared to the world. The arithmetical total ejaculated in a leaky flow, he thought fiercely. My best. At least I'm good at the game. So what? He asked himself. So what? Mr. Job, he thought, help me. The time has come. Tonight. Going rapidly into the tiny bathroom attached to his room, he grabbed up the lid of the water closet of the toilet. Nobody, he had often thought, looks into a toilet. There hung the asbestos sack of quarters. In addition, a small plastic container floated. He had never seen it before in his life. Lifting it from the water, he saw with disbelief that it contained a rolled-up piece of paper, a note, floating in the water closet of his toilet, like a bottle launched at sea. Oh, this can't really be, he thought, and felt like laughing. I mean, Christ, it just can't. But he did not laugh because he felt fear, fear that bordered on dread. It's another communication, he said to himself. Like the one in the mail tube today. But nobody communicates this way. It isn't human. He unscrewed the lid of the small plastic container and groped the enclosed piece of paper out. Yes, it had writing on it. He was right. He read the writing, and then he read it again. I will pay you 35,000 crumbles. What in God's name is a crumble? He asked himself, and the dread sharpened into panic. He felt undernourished, strangulated heat rise to the back of his neck, a weak response somatically. His body, as well as his mind, was trying to adjust to this. It could not be done on a mental level alone, not this. Returning to the main room, he picked up the receiver of the phone and dialed the 24-hour-a-day dictionary service. What's a crumble? He asked when the robot monitor answered. A crumbling substance, the computer fed to the monitor. In other words, fine debris, a small crumb or particle, introduced into English 1577. Other languages? Joe asked. Middle English Kremlin, Old English Gekrimian, Middle High Gothic. What about non-Terran languages? On Betelgeuse 7 in the Erdian tongue, it means a small opening of a temporary nature, a wedge which... That's not it, Joe said. On Rigel, too, it means a small life form which scuttles... Not that either, Joe said. On Sirius 5, in the Plabkian tongue, crumble is a monetary unit. That's it, Joe said. Now tell me how much in Earth money 35,000 crumbles represents. The dictionary robot said, I'm sorry, sir, but you will have to consult the banking service for that answer. Please look in your phone book for the number. It clicked off. The screen died away. He looked up the number and dialed the banking service. We are closed for the night, the banking service robot monitor informed him. All over the world? Joe said in amazement. Everywhere. How long do I have to wait? 4 hours. My life, my entire future. But he was talking into a dead phone. The banking service system had abolished the contact. What I'll do, he decided, is lie down and sleep for 4 hours. It was now 7 o'clock. He could set the alarm for 11. A pressing of the proper button brought the bed sliding out from the wall, virtually to fill the room. It had been his living room, and now it was his bedroom. 4 hours, he said to himself as he set the mechanism of the bed's clock. He lay down, made himself comfortable, as much so as the inadequate bed permitted, and groped for the toggle switch that induced immediately and powerfully the most profound sleep state possible. A buzzer sounded. The damned dream circuit, he said to himself. Even early like this do I have to use it? He leaped up, opened the cabinet beside the bed, and got out the instructions. Yes, mandatory dreaming was required at any time he used the bed. Unless, of course, he threw the sex lever. I'll do that, he said to himself. I'll tell it I'm having knowledge in the biblical sense of a female person. Once more, he lay down and activated the sleep switch. You weigh 140 pounds, the bed said. And there is exactly that weight extended over me. Therefore, you are not engaged in copulation. The mechanism voided his throwing of the sleep toggle switch, and at the same time the bed began to warm up. The heating coils in it blatantly glowed beneath him. He could not argue with an angry bed, so he turned on the sleep-dream interaction and shut his eyes resignedly. Sleep came at once. It always did. The mechanism was perfect. And at once the dream, which everyone anywhere in the world who was now asleep was also dreaming, clicked on. One dream for everyone. But thank God, a different dream each night. Hello there, a cheerful dream voice declared. Tonight's dream was written by Reg Baker and is called In Memory Engraved. Now remember, folks, send in your dream ideas and win huge cash prizes. And if your dream is used, you receive an all-expense-paid trip off Earth entirely, in any direction you desire. The dream began. Joe Fernright stood before the Supreme Fiduciary Council in a state of trembling awe. The secretary of the SFC read from a prepared statement. Mr. Fernright, he declared in a solemn voice, you have in your engraving shop created the plates from which the new money will be printed. Your design out of over 100,000 presented to us, and many of them created with what must be called fantastic cunning, has won. Congratulations, Mr. Fernright. The secretary beamed at him in a fatherly manner, reminding him a little of the padre presence which he now and then made use of. I am pleased and honored, Joe responded, by this award, and I know that I have done my part to restore fiscal stability to the world as we know it. It little matters to me that my face will be pictured on the brightly colored new money, but since it is so, let me express my pleasure at this honor. Your signature, Mr. Fernright, the secretary reminded him in the fashion of a wise father. Your signature, not your face, will appear on the currency notes. Where did you get the idea that it would be your likeness as well? Perhaps you don't understand me, Joe said. Unless my face appears on the new currency, I will withdraw my design, and the entire economic structure of the Earth will collapse, seeing as how you'll have to go on using the old inflationary money, which has by now become virtually waste paper, to be thrown away at the first opportunity. The secretary pondered. You would withdraw your design? You read me loud and clear, Joe, in his dream, in their dream, said. At this same moment, roughly 1 billion other people on Earth were withdrawing their designs, as he now was doing. But of course he had no thought of that. He only knew this. Without him in the system, the whole nature of their corporate state would break apart. And as to my signature, I will, as that great dead hero of the past, Che Guevara, did, that noble person, that fine man who died for his friends. Because of memory of him, I will merely write Joe on the bills. But my face must be of several colors, 3 at least. Mr. Fernright, the secretary said, you strike a hard bargain. You are a firm man. You do, in fact, remind me of Che, and I think all the millions watching on TV will agree. Let's hear it now for Joe Fernright and Che Guevara both together. The secretary threw aside his prepared statement and began to clap. Let's hear out there from all you good people. This is a hero of the state, a new firm-minded man who has spent years working to... Joe's alarm woke him up. Christ, he said to himself groggily. What was that about? Money? Already it had become hazy in his mind. I made the money, he said aloud, blinking, or printed it. Who cares, he said to himself. A dream. Compensation by the state for reality, night after night. It's almost worse than being awake. No, he decided, nothing is worse than being awake. He picked up the phone and dialed the bank. Interplan Corn and Wheat People's Collective Bank. How much are 35,000 crumbles worth in terms of our dollars? Joe asked. Crumbles, as in the Plabkian tongue of Sirius Five? Right. The bank service momentarily was silent, and then it said, 200 gazillion dollars. Really? Joe said. Would I lie to you? The bank robot voice said. I don't even know who you are. Are there any other crumbles? Joe said. That is, the word crumble used as a monetary unit in any other enclave, civilization, tribe, cult, or society in the known universe? There is a defunct crumble known several thousand years ago in the... No, Joe said. This is your active crumble. Thank you and off. He hung up, his ears ringing. He felt as if he had wandered into a titanic auditorium filled with bells of terrible and grand sizes. This must be what they mean by a mystical experience, he said to himself. His front door opened, and two quietude civil authority policemen made their way into the room. As they walked, their keen, frigid glance took in everything inhabiting the room. QCA Himes and Perkin, one of them said as he briefly let Joe see his identification plaque. You're a pot healer, Mr. Fernwright, correct? And you're also on the vet dole, am I right? Yes, I'm right, he finished, answering his own question. What would you say your daily income amounts to, your dole and money received for the alleged work you do? The other QCA man pushed open the door of the bathroom. Something interesting here. The top of the tank, the toilet tank is off. And he's got a bag of metal coins hanging in there. I should guess about 80 quarters. You're a frugal man, Mr. Fernwright. The QCA man came back into the main room. How long? 2 years, Joe said. And I'm not breaking any law. I checked with Mr. Attorney before I began. What's this about 35,000 Plapkin crumbles? Joe hesitated. It was not an unusual phenomenon, his attitude toward the QCA and their men. They had such neat suits, such good gray and brown weaves. Each carried a briefcase. All looked like highly respectable businessmen, prosperous and responsible, able to make decisions. They were not mere bureaucrats to whom orders were given and who merely carried out orders like pseudo-robots. And yet they had an inhumanity about them for no particular reason that he could make out. But then he thought, ah, I have it. No one could ever imagine a QCA man holding open a door for a lady. That was it. That explained his feeling. A small thing, perhaps, but it seemed to be a comprehension of the severe essence of the QCA throughout. Never hold a door, Joe thought. Never take off your hat in an elevator. The ordinary laws of charity did not apply to them, and these laws they did not follow. Ever. But how well shaved they were. How greatly neat. Strange, he thought, how thinking this could give me the feeling that at last I understand them. But I do. In symbolic form, maybe. But the comprehension is there, and it will never go away. I got a note, Joe said. I'll show it to you. He handed them the note which he had found bobbing about in its plastic bottle in the water closet of his facility. Who wrote this? One of the QCA men asked. God knows, Joe said. Is that a joke? Joe said, you mean, is the note a joke, or what I said in answer to your question in saying God knows? He broke off because one of the QCA men was bringing out a teep rod, a receptor which would pick up and record his thoughts for police inspection. You, Joe said, will see that it's true. The rod, wand-like, hovered over his head for several minutes. No one spoke. Then the QCA man returned the rod to his pocket and stuffed a little speaker into his ear. He played back the tape of Joe's thoughts, listening intently. It's so, the QCA man said, and stopped the tape transport, which was located, of course, in his briefcase. He doesn't know anything about this note, who put it there or why. Sorry, Mr. Fernwright. You know, naturally, that we monitor all phone calls. This one interested us because, as you can probably appreciate, the sum involved is so large. His companion cop said, report to us once a day about this matter. He handed Joe a card. The number you're to call is on the card. You don't have to ask for anyone in particular. Tell whoever answers the call what's developed. The first QCA man said, "There isn't anything legal that you could do to get paid 35,000 Plapke and Crumbles, Mr. Fernwright. It has to be illegal. That's how we see it." "Maybe there are a hell of a lot of broken pots on Sirius 5," Joe said. "Bit of humor there," the first QCA man said tartly. He nodded to his companion, and the two of them opened the door and departed from his room. The door closed behind them. "Maybe it's one gigantic pot," Joe said loudly. "A pot the size of a planet, with 50 glazes and..." He gave up. They probably couldn't hear him anyhow. "And originally ornamented by the greatest graphic artist in Plabkian history," he thought. "And it's the only product of his genius left, and an earthquake has broken the pot, which is locally worshipped. So the whole Plabkian civilization has collapsed." Plabkian civilization. He thought. "Just how far developed are they on Sirius 5?" he asked himself. "A good question." Going to the phone, he dialed the encyclopedia number. "Good evening," a robotic voice said. "What info do you require, sir or madam?" Joe said, "Give me a brief description of the social development on Sirius 5. Without the passing of even a tenth second, the artificial voice said, "It is an ancient society which has seen better days. The current dominant species on the planet consists of what is called a Glimmung. This shadowy, enormous entity is not native to the planet. It migrated there several centuries ago, taking over from the feeble species such as wubs, wurges, clakes, trobes, and printers left over when the once ruling master species, the so-called fog things of antiquity, passed away." "Glimmung, the Glimmung, is all-powerful?" Joe asked. "His power," the encyclopedia's voice said, "is sharply curtailed by a peculiar book, probably non-existent, in which, it is alleged, everything which has been, is, and will be, is recorded." Joe said, "Where did this book come from?" "You have used up your allotted quantity of information," the voice said, and clicked off. Joe waited exactly 3 minutes and then redialed the number. "Good evening. What info do you require, sir or madam?" "The book on Sirius 5, Joe said, "which is alleged to tell everything that has been..." "Oh, it's you again. Well, your trick won't work anymore. We store voice patterns now." It rang off. "That's right," Joe realized. "I remember reading in the newspaper about that. It was costing the government too much money the way it was, when we did what I tried to do just now." "Nuts," he said to himself. 24 hours before he could get any more free information. Of course, he could go to a private enterprise encyclopedia booth, to Mr. Encyclopedia, but it would cost as much as he had stored in his asbestos bag. The government, when licensing the non-state-owned enterprises such as Mr. Attorney and Mr. Encyclopedia and Mr. Job, had seen to that. "I think I got aced out," Joe Fernwright said to himself. "As usual." "Our society," he thought broodingly, "is the perfect form of government. Everyone is aced out in the end."